Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
Pulled Thread by Rodrigo Assis Mesquite, with music by Red Blue Black Silver, read by Zara Khan.
I held my mother's hand in that hospital bed until the end. Amanda, who had just turned 11, came along. Valeria didn't want her daughter there. It was no place for a kid, she said. But the girl put her foot down. I want to be with Mandita. Those rosy, chubby cheeks won every time. Valeria was a single mom. Her husband scurried away when fatherhood struck him. I'm not cut out to be a father, he told her, leaving behind only a threadbare black and white tie and a growing belly. She had no recollection of her father, who supposedly died when she was a toddler, and her mother was a woman who, despite ill-suited to live her own life, did nothing but judge Valeria. Broke and broken, abortion was a notion that crossed Valeria's mind until her lives intertwined at that bus stop right in front of the clinic. I knew exactly when she would be there. Truth be told, I knew about her since my earliest memories, when I first saw a giraffe in a zoo in Sao Paulo. I helped Valeria as best as she would let me. She was in her senior year at college, about to get a computer engineering degree. The books were expensive, and nobody would hire a pregnant woman. I knew about those hard times. But living then as an adult made my heart boil. I will pay you back, Valeria said matter-of-factly when she moved in, as if I were collecting rent. Yeah, I loved her, but she got on my nerves from time to time. She was like the mother I knew, stubborn like a mule. I enjoy driving, Mandita, Mom would tell me with the cigarette nearly falling from the corner of her mouth. When it's 3 a.m, Janis Joplin is screaming on the radio, and I'm on a 2-lane road where Judas dropped his boots in Mato Grosso, and the drizzle is gently falling on the windshield, going plack, plack, plack. It's like going into a tunnel to another world. Addicted to meth, her truck rolled over on an ordinary dawn, and she totaled our time together. Before I embarked on this journey, my coworkers warned me it was wrong meddling with the past. Space-time is like a wool sweater. A pulled thread can unravel it all to oblivion. I held tight to my childhood keychain until it hurt the palm of my hand and ignored them. Valeria deserved a second chance in life. My plan went well, mostly. If I dribbled her pride or if she just got used to me, I'm not sure. I took advantage of my far-advanced engineering skills and knowledge from the future, started a high-tech company, and hired Valeria. Having historical information was not insider trading, so getting the money was fairly easy. Considering the butterfly effect didn't take place, my trip didn't modify events like lottery results and stock prices. So I made few lucrative investments, enough to profit under the radar of the regulators. To try and make up for any bad karma, not that I believed in it, I set up a foundation dedicated to support and advance the education of single mothers. The company thrived and became a reference in the market. Valeria graduated with honors and, 4 years later, got her PhD. Her thesis established the basis for time traveling, and it made me anxious. Was there a time police or something of the sort coming for me, for us? Nothing happened, and I figured maybe I was expecting too much from humankind. But I started to wear out. Knowledge increasingly slipped my mind. I blamed stress, traffic, bad habits. I have to slow down, I said to myself. Just in case, though, I took up the habit of taking notes on important information, especially on all the fundamental theorems and equations necessary to the construction of the time-traveling machine. Amanda, who preferred to be called Mandita, spent a lot of time with me. Funny how I would lose myself in our childhood whenever we played video games or went to the zoo. Her jaw dropped when she laid eyes on the giraffe. She used to spend hours drawing rockets and robots and developing theories about sci-fi movies and books, and we shared little things about our days. I even told her exciting things about the future. Maybe I shouldn't have, but Mandita was too young. The information would surely get lost like socks in the washing machine of the past. One day, I came to in the middle of a shopping center. I was standing there as if I were a sleepwalker waking up. Amanda was pulling my hand, weeping, calling my name. I went to specialists and was subjected to various medical exams. I was scanned, poked, and bled. The diagnosis? Metastatic brain tumor. The doctor was puzzled when I laughed at the news. In my time, brain cancer was as fatal as a paper cut. In the now, it was a death sentence. Once again defying the ominous warnings from my past, or future, co-workers, I asked the nurse to bring me pen and paper and wrote a letter to my mom, Valeria, in my dreadful handwriting. I told her that I loved her and had no regrets coming to meet her, that I was happy I got to know her, an amazing woman and mother, and how proud I was of her, and that Mandita loved her more than she could ever admit, more than I could ever admit. I told her life was like a truck at 3 a.m. under a Mato Grosso drizzle. It was better to take the wheel and take a chance than to stay on the sidewalk, afraid. Valeria, my mom, a woman younger than me, brought red-eyed Amanda for one last time. The girl hugged me tight. "Don't cry. Everything will be all right. I am sure of it," she said. Amanda was growing up, becoming more myself each day. "Here, Mandita, take this. It was my mom's." I gave her the truck's keychain. When Amanda was born, I asked Valeria if she had named the baby after me. She shrugged it off, but I glimpsed a smile. At least, I think I did. Valeria told Amanda to wait outside for a moment, sat on the bed, and, lightly brushing my hair with her fingertips, promised me, "Mandita, I will build the machine you designed, and I will save you, you'll see, and we will meet again on this road." I didn't say anything, but she gave off the strong smell of cigarettes. I smiled through the pain. My mom stayed with me in that hospital bed until the end.
The Day the Hooks Came by Jean-Paul L. Garnier, with music by Fog Machine, read by the author and Zara Kand. It didn't seem strange because we'd all heard of the space elevator. None of us had seen one, but we knew it was some kind of cable from the sky. Why they wanted to make something like that, we couldn't say. Guess they weren't happy here on Earth. Some wanted to leave, others just wanted to go back to the simple life. The world moved so fast in those days that most folks stopped trying to keep up at all. A lot of things had simply grown too complicated for the average Joe to comprehend, so they became invisible in plain sight. I was walking down Main Street the first time I saw one, on my way to the diner for lunch as usual. I met Betty there at noon 3 times a week. It was our ritual. Everyone always thought we were a couple, or suggested that we become one. But it wasn't like that. I smiled at her through the window. She was sitting in our usual booth, a cup of coffee already waiting for me. As I rounded the corner, heading for the door, I saw it. Looked like a piece of aircraft cable, but smooth, hanging right out of the sky like it belonged there. A man almost walked straight into it and stumbled back. A crowd started to gather. "Are you sure you should be touching that?" I called out to the brave kid that was slowly advancing on the object and poking at it with a stick. He ran off without answering. A few of the pedestrians shrugged and walked away, already bored of the object. It wasn't that unusual for some newfangled tech thingy to be hooked up to the lamppost or whatnot. Things were always changing, so we stopped seeing the changes. Most folks had turned their curiosity inward, if anywhere. I too lost interest and didn't want to keep Betty waiting any longer.
"Get lost on your way in?"
she teased. "Just chasing off the street urchins. Some new piece of tech hanging out of the sky. Never can tell if it's supposed to be there or if some kid's going to get hurt," I said over the rim of the coffee. It smelled good, and she had put exactly the right amount of cream in for my taste. We chatted about our days and ordered sandwiches. In the corner of my eye, I could see Steve, the cook, shaking his head. He always did this when he saw us, as if to say, "What a waste. You obviously love each other." And we did, just not in that way. The screech of brakes drew my attention from the counter. Betty gasped. Outside the window, a commotion was breaking out. A car had almost hit some of the kids hanging out on the curb. People were shouting too, but not at the driver. He got out of his car and joined the gaping crowd, all pointing up and exclaiming in hushed voices.
"What do you figure they're getting on about?"
Betty asked. I was about to tell her that I didn't know when a man broke off from the crowd and came into the diner shouting,
"It took Jimmy. He's gone. Went straight up into the sky."
He was in a kind of panic and spoke to try and figure out what's real, more so than to inform anyone.
"Well, that was more exciting than most lunches,"
Betty said sarcastically while looking at her watch. We finished our sandwiches and went Dutch on the bill. As usual, I was going to walk her back to work. Outside, there was still a crowd. Some of them pointed up, and a few were shouting. One man wagged his finger disapprovingly.
"I tell you, I saw it first. He had no right to cut me off. It was mine, fair and square."
There was genuine anger in his voice. "Hold on for a second, Betty." I approached the man slowly, curious what all the hubbub was about. "Excuse me, sir, what did you see first? What's going on here?" He looked at me, eyes filled with fresh anger.
"That cable that came down from the sky, that was for me. Had a check with my name on it. I saw the figure too. It was the exact sum I need to save my business. A gift from heaven, if you ask me. And then that guy ran up, saying something about dreams of flying. Grabbed the cable and went sailing up into the sky. Took the check with him too. I tell you, it isn't right. It was meant for me."
I heard what he said, but it wasn't making a lot of sense to me. Betty was tugging on my sleeve, so I turned, forgetting all about the man and his check from heaven. Crowds were gathered all over the sidewalk on both sides of the street. Some were arguing, and then a gasp overtook the crowds as another pedestrian shot up into the sky, holding onto another of the cables for dear life. I took Betty by the hand. "Those cables are everywhere. What do you think is going on?" I could feel Betty's hand go all clammy. She squeezed tighter out of fear.
"I don't know, Frank. Folks are acting pretty strange. I don't like it,"
she replied. We headed north in the direction of Betty's office, fortunately, away from the growing throng. Betty loosened her grip on my hand, slowly calming down, but the commotion behind us continued. We made it 2 blocks up the road without incident. Then, across the street, another cable dropped through the clear blue sky down to the sidewalk. A man ran up to it, exclaiming nothing but joy.
All my dreams come true. I can't believe it. I've waited my whole life for something.
I couldn't hear the rest of what he said, as he was yanked up into the air and out of earshot. Betty's nails dug into my hand.
Oh, Frank, what's going on?
I didn't have an answer for her, but when I looked around, I saw cables coming down all over the block, running people heading toward them, some of them fighting to get there first. And all of them were exuberant, smiles painted with tears, many shouting, faces looking like prayers were being answered in real time. Then the cables took them one by one. The street was growing emptier by the minute. Another cable fell right in front of us. The rest of the street blurred to nothing as the cable came into focus. Sparkling in front of me was a ring in a little ornate box. The same I had eyed for years in the jeweler's window. The one I let myself think about and get carried away dreaming of a life with Betty that we both knew was not meant to be. I reached out for it, and Betty quickly slapped my hand away.
"That's mine,"
she snapped. How did she know? I had never admitted it to anyone, not even fully to myself. But the anger in her eyes was real. She looked at me as though I was trying to steal her most prized possession. It didn't make sense. She never got angry with me. "What do you mean, Betty? What do you see?" I tried to keep my voice calm. She reached for the cable and I stalled her hand. "Betty, tell me what you're seeing." She looked entranced. All the crowds did. She reached again, and this time I had to use some force to prevent her from grabbing the cable. It only served to make her madder.
"All my life I've had one big unattainable dream,"
she started.
"And now it's here in front of me and you're trying to stop me from having it."
"I'm not following you. What do you mean? What do you see?" Now there were tears in her eyes.
"Can't you see it too? It's a plane ticket with my name on it. My prayers are answered. I finally get to go to Paris."
"Betty, I don't think it's real. That's not what I see. I see the ring that I always wanted to get for you." Now I'd done it. I'd admitted what I had promised myself I would never admit. There was no going back. Now she knew.
"No, it's a plane ticket."
She pushed me out of the way and latched onto the cable. In seconds, her feet were above my head, and I reached out to try and grab her, but only came away with a single shoe. She was gone, and with her, my private dream. The streets were almost empty now, and it had grown quiet. Cables still hung down from the sky, but the few of us left did not reach for them. Wonderment had filled the faces of the people who had been taken. Tears were abundant. Some of them had the look of deep loss. I thought about my father taking me fishing all those years ago. He had told me his secret on that father-son trip. "The trick to catching a fish, son, is to have the right bait for the right fish. If you show them something that looks just like what they want, they'll jump right onto your hook and practically beg for the frying pan." In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard Pulled Thread by Rodrigo Assis Mezquita, with music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. And The Day the Hooks Came by Jean-Paul L. Garnier with music by Fog Machine. Theme music by Dane Luscombe. Out now, Simultaneous Times Volume 2 Paperback Science Fiction Anthology. And this month, we have a special free gift for you at our new website, spacecowboybooks.com. Download the free ebook, Simultaneous Times Volume 2.5, with stories you've heard here on this podcast and some that you haven't. Get in touch with us on Instagram and Twitter. We'd love to know what you think of the show.